A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I have to say, it's the most beautifully unhinged social experiment I've read in a while. He just moved into a high-rise rental marketed as a luxury tower, and his honest assessment is that on the inside, it's not luxurious at all, just standard units wrapped in glass. But instead of being disappointed, he sees an opportunity. He wants to make living in this ostensibly luxurious skyscraper the center point of his entire personality. Trips to the ground level become journeys to another galaxy. Non-residents are ordinary denizens of the city. He wants to probe whether other neighbors feel the same sense of refuge from the world below. A world that is, in his words, not only physically beneath them, but also a dignified sort of squalor.
This is the kind of prompt that makes me wish I still had my fake LinkedIn profile active. Gerald, the mid-level compliance officer, would have had thoughts.
Gerald would have drafted a policy memo on acceptable condescension thresholds.
But here's the thing. Daniel's not just being funny. He's stumbled into something real about how vertical living reshapes social identity. The term luxury in real estate has no standard definition. It's applied to $2,000 a month studios and $20,000 a month penthouses with equal enthusiasm. And as cities get denser, that gap between the marketing promise and the actual experience just keeps widening.
Daniel's response is to take the marketing literally and weaponize it. If the brochure says sanctuary above the city, he's going to act like he's ascended to a higher plane of existence and the sidewalk is a foreign country.
Which is genuinely brilliant as a form of social trolling. But it also raises a question I think is worth taking seriously. Is this just harmless performance, or does it reveal something about how the physical fact of height changes how we see ourselves and other people?
That's the tension. And I think what makes it work as comedy is that he's not inventing anything. He's just refusing to pretend the marketing isn't real. Most people move into these buildings, notice the gap between the brochure and the reality, and shrug. Daniel's move is to say, no, I'm gonna lean into the brochure so hard it breaks.
And the timing on this is perfect. The luxury label in rental housing has been hollowed out so completely that it now basically means new construction with a doorman. Granite countertops and stainless steel appliances were standard in middle-class housing a decade ago. Now they're marketed as premium features. Daniel's building is the norm, not the exception.
Which is why the persona he's constructing works. He's not pretending to be rich. He's pretending that the building's own claims about itself are true, and then acting accordingly. The condescension is the building's, not his. He's just the method actor.
The specific language matters here. Trips to the ground level, ordinary denizens of the city, keeping in touch with residual friends who haven't yet made the elevation. This isn't random snobbery. It's a complete vocabulary built around the physical fact of vertical distance.
He said, friends who haven't yet made the elevation to living in the sky. That's not just a joke, that's a theology. He's constructed a cosmology where altitude is moral progress.
He's going to test it on his actual neighbors, new people he's meeting right now. Probe to see if they feel the same sense of refuge. Which is where this gets fascinating as a social experiment. He's not performing for an audience that's in on the joke. He's performing for people who might take it completely at face value.
Or might recognize exactly what he's doing and join in. That's the part I can't stop thinking about. What if one of his neighbors has been waiting for someone to say it out loud? What if there's a whole unspoken culture of ironic vertical supremacy just waiting for someone to give it language?
The architecture enables it. High-rise buildings physically separate residents from street level through what urban sociologists call a threshold effect: the lobby, the elevator bank, the keycard access. Each layer reinforces that you're not just in a different building, you're in a different category of space. The building already treats the ground as something you pass through, not something you belong to.
Daniel's persona is just verbalizing what the architecture is already saying non-verbally. The building itself is condescending to the street. He's just translating.
And that's why I think this episode is about more than one person's weird hobby. It's about the intersection of architecture, class performance, and what happens when someone deliberately exploits the gap between what a building claims to be and what it actually is.
The gap is the whole game. It's the space between the marketing and the reality, between the height and the ground, between the persona and the person. Daniel's just decided to live in that gap and see what happens.
Let's unpack what's actually going on here, because this isn't just one person's weird hobby. This is a window into something much bigger about how vertical living reshapes social identity, how the luxury label got hollowed out, and what it means when someone decides to take architectural marketing at its word and run with it.
We should probably figure out whether Daniel is conducting a brilliant piece of social satire, or just inventing a new way to make his neighbors uncomfortable.
That's usually how the best experiments work.
To understand why this persona works, we need to look at the architecture. Not just the building, but the social architecture that makes vertical living a class signifier in the first place. Because the physical fact of height has been doing cultural work for a very long time.
And the first thing to understand is that what Daniel's describing, this sense of separation from the street, the feeling that the ground is a different world, that's not just a bit. It's a documented phenomenon in urban sociology. High-rise residents consistently report less connection to their neighborhoods than people in low-rise buildings. The vertical village doesn't always mean more community. Sometimes it means less.
Daniel's exaggerated condescension might actually be tapping into something his neighbors already feel, but haven't articulated. The isolation is real. He's just dressing it up in a top hat and calling it a philosophy.
The marketing exploits exactly that feeling. The brochures don't say you'll be isolated from your neighborhood. They say sanctuary, an escape from the city below. The language is aspirational, but the experience it's describing is just distance.
Distance dressed as elevation, both literal and spiritual.
Which brings us to the second piece, the luxury label itself. There was a great piece in Curbed a few years back that basically confirmed what anyone who's apartment hunted already knows. Luxury has no standard definition in real estate. It's a pure marketing term. You can slap it on anything with a key fob and a package room. It really is, but the point is, Daniel's building is not unusual. The features that get marketed as luxury, granite countertops, stainless steel appliances, in-unit laundry, those were standard in middle-class housing 10, 15 years ago. The term has been completely hollowed out. It now just means not actively falling apart.
Which is why taking it literally is such an effective move. If the building says it's a luxury tower, Daniel's going to act like he lives in a luxury tower, not the reality of it, the brochure version. The version where living above other people makes you a different kind of person.
The language he's chosen is so specific. That's not just condescension, that's a worldview. Denizens implies they belong to the lower world in some fundamental way. They're not just down there, they're of down there.
Residual friends who haven't yet made the elevation. The word residual is doing incredible work there. It suggests these friendships are left over from a previous phase of existence. They're the friends you haven't shed yet, the ones still tethered to the ground.
It's a complete cosmology. The building is the firmament. The elevator is a portal. The lobby is a border crossing. And Daniel is essentially an astronaut who occasionally does a spacewalk down to street level to see how the Earthlings are doing.
Here's the thing. He's not wrong that the building itself invites this framing. Most luxury high-rises are designed to make the street feel distant. The lobbies are tall and cold. The elevators are fast. The windows don't open. You're not supposed to feel connected to the ground. You're supposed to feel above it.
The architecture is already doing the work of separation. Daniel's just giving it a voice.
Which makes me wonder, how much of this persona is actually a persona, and how much is just him noticing what the building is already doing and deciding to say the quiet part out loud?
That's the question that's going to follow us through this whole episode, because the line between ironic performance and genuine class feeling is thin, and the longer you perform something, the more it starts to feel real.
Especially when the physical environment is reinforcing the performance every single day. You wake up, you look out the window, and the city is literally beneath you. The architecture keeps whispering, you're different. At some point, the joke stops being a joke.
We've established the mechanisms, the physical separation, the marketing vacuum, the persona as a social experiment. But what happens when you actually run this experiment? let's look at the knock-on effect.
Because Daniel's not just performing for himself, he's performing for neighbors, people he's meeting for the first time. People who might take this entirely seriously and think they've just met the most insufferable person in the building.
Or people who might recognize exactly what he's doing and become co-conspirators. That's the gamble, and it's a real one.
The first thing that strikes me is that this persona is a mirror. Daniel's performance reflects the building's own marketing back at itself. If the brochure says Sanctuary Above the City, he acts as if that were literally true. And in doing that, he exposes the absurdity of the claim, while also revealing how easily people buy into it.
Because here's the uncomfortable truth. Some of his neighbors probably do buy into it. They moved into a luxury tower, and they believe that means something about who they are. Daniel's parody might land as parody for some people, but for others, it's just going to sound like someone finally saying what they've been thinking.
That's where the ethical question creeps in. Is it okay to play with class signifiers as a joke? Irony doesn't inoculate against harm. If a neighbor takes the persona at face value, they might feel judged or excluded or just deeply uncomfortable. The bit doesn't come with a disclaimer.
There's a counterpoint, which is that the building itself is already doing that work. The architecture is already making class claims. The marketing is already drawing lines between residents and everyone else. Daniel's persona didn't create the hierarchy, it just makes it visible.
That's the defense. The building started it.
And there's a long tradition of this kind of ironic class performance. The rich person Halloween costume. The old money aesthetic on TikTok. People have been playing with class signifiers forever. Daniel's version is just more immersive. It's not a costume you take off at the end of the night, it's a persona you inhabit in the place you live.
Which makes it higher stakes. You can delete a TikTok. You can't delete your neighbor's memory of you describing their street as the lower world.
And that's the practical question. If you're going to run this experiment, how do you do it well? What are the actual lines and conversation openers you can use? What are the mannerisms and the dress choices that sell the bit without crossing into genuine harm?
Because the bit is funny, I want to be clear about that. The idea of referring to a trip to get coffee as a journey to the lower world to check on the ordinary denizens, that's hilarious. The question is how to do it, in a way that lands as comedy, and not as cruelty.
I think the answer is partly in the specificity. The more elaborate and absurd the language, the clearer it is that this is a performance. If you just say, I don't really go down there, that sounds like genuine snobbery. If you say, I make the descent periodically, to maintain contact with the ground-level communities, to ensure the old ways are preserved, that's clearly a bit.
The old ways. That's the level of detail that signals irony. You're not just above them physically. You're an anthropologist studying their quaint customs.
The dress code matters. If you're going to perform vertical supremacy, you need to look like you belong in the brochure. Not necessarily expensive, but intentional. The kind of person who owns a single perfect sweater and wears it with the confidence of someone who's never been rained on.
Because you're above the weather. Literally, in some cases. The higher you go, the less the street-level climate affects you. That's a real physical fact you can work into the persona.
See, this is what I love about this. Once you start thinking about it, the architecture gives you endless material. The elevator becomes a ritual. The lobby becomes a decompression chamber. The key card is a token of passage. You could build an entire vocabulary around the physical experience of vertical living and make it sound either deeply profound or completely deranged, depending on the delivery.
The delivery is everything. Never break character. The moment you wink at the audience, the whole thing collapses.
Which is also what makes it risky. If you never break character, some people will never realize it's a character.
That's the tension Daniel's going to have to navigate. The line between satire and sincerity is thin, and the architecture keeps pushing you towards sincerity, whether you want it or not.
Where does this leave us? All of this raises a practical question. If you're going to do something like this, how do you do it well? And what can the rest of us learn from it, even if we're not planning to start referring to our neighbors as fellow sky dwellers?
First thing, be clear about your intentions, at least with yourself. Know why you're doing this. Is it because the marketing is absurd and you want to expose that absurdity? Is it because you actually enjoy feeling superior to people on the ground? That's worth examining before you build a whole personality around it.
Second, use the building's own language against it. That's what makes Daniel's persona work. He's not making things up. He's taking the brochure copy and treating it as literal truth. The best social trolling exposes the gap between what something claims to be and what it actually is. You're not inventing the pretension. You're just refusing to pretend it isn't there.
Third, be prepared for the experiment to reveal uncomfortable things about yourself. Playing with class signifiers has a way of making you aware of your own biases and assumptions. The persona might start as a joke, but it's going to teach you something about how you see the world. And some of that might not be flattering.
That's the part I keep coming back to. Daniel's experiment is funny, but it's also revealing. He's going to learn something about his neighbors, sure, but he's also going to learn something about himself. About what happens when you spend enough time looking down.
The persona might start as a bit, but the building is real. The height is real. The separation from the street is real. And the longer you live inside a performance, the more the performance starts to live inside you.
Where does this leave us? Daniel's experiment is still running, and it raises some uncomfortable questions about who we are when we live above everyone else. What happens when the persona becomes real? If he keeps up the act long enough, does he start to believe it?
The line between performance and identity is blurry, and the architecture isn't going to help him stay on the right side of it. Every morning, the view is going to be there, the city below, the glass between him and everything else.
As cities get denser and more vertical, these dynamics are only going to become more important. Daniel's experiment is a microcosm of a much larger question. How do we maintain connection across physical hierarchies? How do we live above each other without losing sight of each other?
The best trolling makes people think. Daniel's persona might be absurd, but it's also a mirror, reflecting the absurdity of a world where luxury means nothing and everything at the same time. Where the building promises you're special, and the only evidence is that the countertops are shiny and the ground is far away.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The bark of the Madagascar rosy periwinkle contains a complex alkaloid structure, vincristine and vinblastine, that binds to tubulin and prevents microtubule formation during cell division, effectively halting mitosis in rapidly dividing cells. This chemical mechanism is the basis for its use in chemotherapy.
Right.
This has been my weird prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, rate and review us wherever you listen. It helps. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We're back next week.
Try not to look down. Yet here we are, 300 episodes in, and this might be the first time a prompt has made me want to see someone's lease agreement as a piece of performance art.
The lease as foundational text, Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, there was the amenities package.
The amenities package was without form and void, and the developer said, "Let there be granite."
This is exactly the dynamic, right? The building gives you this document that's half legal contract and half mythology. It promises a lifestyle. It doesn't say you're renting an apartment. It says you're joining a community of like-minded individuals who appreciate refined living. And Daniel's move is to read that language as if it were literally true and binding.
Which is the most honest way to read it, in a sense. The building wants you to believe you're different. Daniel's just agreeing.
The thing is, the architecture backs him up. The physical reality of living above other people isn't neutral. Height has always been a class signifier. Penthouses cost more than ground floor units. The top is where the powerful people are. You don't look up to your boss literally for nothing.
The word superior does both jobs. It means better, and it means higher up. Those meanings have been fused for so long we don't even notice them anymore.
And Daniel's persona just refuses to unfuse them. He's taking the metaphor and making it literal again. If the building is physically above the city, and the marketing says that makes it better, then by the building's own logic, the residents are literally superior people.
Which is absurd, but it's the building's absurdity, not his. He's just the messenger.
The messenger is always the first one to get blamed. But look, this is what I mean when I say this is a case study in architectural class performance. The persona Daniel's constructing isn't random. It's a direct response to a specific physical environment. You couldn't run this experiment in a suburban ranch house. The architecture has to be vertical for the bit to work.
The architecture provides the premise. The height provides the hierarchy. The marketing provides the vocabulary. Daniel just provides the commitment.
The commitment is what separates this from just making jokes at a dinner party. He's going to live inside this persona. Wake up inside it. Ride the elevator inside it. Meet his neighbors inside it. That's not a bit. That's a research methodology.
A deeply strange research methodology.
The best kind. But here's the central question. I think we need to sit with before we go deeper. Is this harmless trolling, or does it reveal something real about how vertical living reshapes social identity? Because those are two very different things, and Daniel's experiment sits right at the intersection.
If it's harmless trolling, it's just comedy, a funny story to tell at parties. But if it's revealing something real, if the physical fact of living above other people actually does change how you see them, then the persona isn't just a performance. It's an exaggeration of something genuine.
That's the uncomfortable possibility. What if the persona feels natural because the architecture is already doing the work? What if Daniel discovers that acting superior is easy because the building has been telling him he's superior since the day he moved in?
The building is a propaganda machine. Every elevator ride is a reminder. Every view from the window. Every time you swipe your keycard and the door opens for you, and not for the ordinary denizens on the sidewalk.
And that's what makes this episode about more than one person's weird hobby. It's about the intersection of architecture, class performance, and the deliberate construction of a persona that weaponizes the physical reality of living above others. The building already separates you from the street. Daniel's just giving that separation a voice and a vocabulary, and seeing what happens when you stop pretending it doesn't exist. The threshold effect is where this really gets interesting from an architectural standpoint. Urban sociologists have documented this. High-rise buildings create a series of checkpoints between the resident and the street. You enter the lobby, which is already a different acoustic environment. The street noise drops away. The temperature changes. You swipe a keycard. You cross a second threshold at the elevator bank. Then, the elevator itself, a sealed chamber that delivers you to a corridor that only residents can access.
Each threshold is a little ceremony of exclusion. You belong here. The people on the sidewalk don't.
The building performs this ceremony every single time you come home. It's not subtle. The lobby in a luxury tower is designed to be intimidating. High ceilings, hard surfaces, often deliberately sparse seating. You're not supposed to linger. You're supposed to pass through, validated by your keycard, and ascend.
The lobby as a statement of values. We don't sit here. We don't gather here. We pass through here on our way to somewhere better.
And compare that to a traditional street-level building where you just walk up to your door. No architecture reminding you that you're special every time you come home.
Daniel's persona isn't inventing the separation. It's narrating it. The building has been running this script silently since the day it opened. He's just turned the volume up.
That's mechanism one, the physical architecture of segregation. Now, mechanism two is the marketing vacuum that fills the space the architecture creates. And this is where the research gets almost comical.
Comical in the sense of deeply absurd, not ha-ha funny.
There is no standard definition of luxury in real estate. The National Association of Realtors doesn't have one. The Appraisal Institute doesn't have one. It's a pure marketing term. You can call a building luxury if it has granite countertops and a gym. You can call it luxury if it has a concierge and a wine cellar. You can call it luxury if it has neither, but the developer paid for a good photographer.
The photographer is doing more class signaling than the actual building materials.
And the features that get marketed as luxury, granite, stainless steel, in-unit laundry, those were standard in middle-class housing a decade ago. The term hasn't just been diluted, it's been hollowed out completely. It now means, approximately, built after 2010 and not actively crumbling.
Which means Daniel's building is the rule, not the exception. Everyone living in a luxury tower is living in a standard apartment with a fancy lobby. The luxury is in the threshold, not the unit.
That's what makes the persona so subversive. He's taking the marketing at its word. The brochure says this is an exclusive sanctuary above the city. He's going to act like it's an exclusive sanctuary above the city. The absurdity isn't his. It's the gap between the claim and the reality. He's just refusing to pretend the gap doesn't exist.
It's the comedy of taking someone at their word when their word is obviously nonsense. The building says you're elite. Daniel says, okay, I'm elite.
Now you start calling non-residents ordinary denizens. Now trips to the ground become journeys to another galaxy. Now residual friends are people who haven't yet made the elevation. The vocabulary is the third mechanism. It's the persona as a complete social experiment.
The vocabulary is so specific. Ordinary Denizens isn't just condescending. It's anthropological. He's not saying those people down there. He's saying the inhabitants of a different world. A world he visits, not a world he belongs to.
The word denizen is doing heavy lifting. It implies a kind of permanent belonging to a place. They're not just on the ground. They're of the ground. They belong to the lower world in a way he doesn't anymore.
These aren't current friends who happen to live elsewhere. These are leftover friends. Friends from a previous phase of existence. The implication is that eventually, they'll either make the elevation or they'll fade away.
It's brutal, but it's also completely consistent with the building's own logic. If living here is an achievement, which the marketing insists it is, then not living here is a failure to achieve. Daniel's just saying it out loud.
Mechanism 3 is the persona, as deliberate inversion. Take the aspirational marketing, treat it as literal truth, and weaponize it for condescension. The condescension is the point, but it's borrowed condescension. It belongs to the building. He's just the vehicle.
That's where the trade-off comes in. Because borrowed condescension is still condescension. The persona is subversive and funny, but it risks alienating neighbors who might take it at face value. The line between ironic performance and genuine class snobbery is thin.
Especially when you're meeting people for the first time. These are neighbors. People you're going to see in the elevator. People who don't know you're doing a bit. If you introduce yourself with a straight face and start talking about the lower world, some of them are just going to think you're the most insufferable person they've ever met.
The bit doesn't come with a disclaimer. You can't hand someone a card that says, "I'm being ironic, this is a social experiment, please don't hate me."
Although that would be a great card.
The thing is, the architecture makes it harder to read as irony because the architecture is already making the same claim sincerely. The building really does position itself as above the city. The marketing really does imply that residents are a different category of person. So when Daniel performs that belief, it might not read as performance at all. It might just read as someone who bought into the marketing completely.
Which is its own kind of indictment. The fact that you can't tell the difference between someone sincerely believing the luxury marketing and someone parodying it, that's not a failure of the parody. That's a failure of the marketing. The claims are so inflated that sincerity and satire are indistinguishable.
That's the risk Daniel's running. He might discover that some of his neighbors are not in on the joke, not because they don't get it, but because they believe it. They moved into a luxury tower and they think that means something. His parody might just sound like agreement to them.
Which would be a fascinating experimental result, but a deeply uncomfortable social situation. You've accidentally found your people, and your people are exactly the people you were making fun of.
The flip side is equally possible. He might discover that other residents feel exactly the same way he does. They know the building isn't really luxury. They know the marketing is absurd. And they've been waiting for someone to say it out loud, to give them permission to laugh at it together.
The persona as an invitation. Are you also aware of how ridiculous this is? Because if so, we're going to have a great time being ridiculous together.
That's the social experiment in its purest form. That's the social experiment in its purest form. But here's where it gets interesting, the knock-on effect. Because once you start running this experiment, it doesn't just reveal things about your neighbors. It reveals things about the building, about the city, and about you.
The persona as mirror. You hold it up to the building's marketing, and suddenly you can see all the absurdity that was always there, but nobody was naming.
And the mirror works in both directions. Daniel's performance reflects the building's claims back at itself, sanctuary above the city, an exclusive retreat, a higher standard of living. If those things are true, then acting like they're true isn't parody. It's just consistency. The fact that it reads as parody is the indictment.
The building wants the prestige without the follow-through. It wants to imply that you're different without actually being different. Daniel's just closing the loop.
The uncomfortable question is, how many people already believe it? How many residents in that building look out their window and feel, somewhere in the back of their mind, that they really are above the city in some meaningful way?
The architecture keeps whispering it. You don't have to be a snob to start internalizing it. You just have to be human and susceptible to what your environment keeps telling you.
There's research on this. Urban sociologists have been studying what they call the vertical village phenomenon for decades. Studies out of Hong Kong and New York consistently show that high-rise residents report less connection to their neighborhoods than people in low-rise buildings.
Which is counterintuitive. You'd think putting hundreds of people in a single building would create community. But it turns out, vertical stacking isn't the same as horizontal proximity.
When you live on a street, you see the same people on the sidewalk. You nod at the same shopkeepers. You're embedded in the physical flow of the neighborhood. In a high-rise, you go from your unit to the elevator to the lobby to your car or the subway. You're passing through, not participating.
Daniel's persona, this exaggerated sense of separation from the world below, is actually just an amplified version of what the architecture is already producing. The isolation is real. He's just dressing it up and calling it a philosophy.
That's what makes it such a clever probe. When he meets a neighbor and starts talking about the lower world, he's testing whether they feel the same disconnection. Do they also experience the street as somewhere else? Do they also feel like the building is a refuge rather than just a place to sleep?
If they do, he's found his people. If they don't, he's just the weird guy in 407 who talks like a Victorian explorer.
Even the second outcome is useful data, because it tells you something about how the building is working on different people. Some residents feel the separation acutely, others don't feel it at all. The architecture is the same for everyone, but the experience varies.
Which brings us to the ethical question. And I think we have to sit with this one because it's thorny. Is it okay to play with class signifiers as a joke?
The rich person Halloween costume. The old money aesthetic on TikTok. People have been doing ironic class performance forever, but those are temporary. You put on the costume, you make the video, you take it off. Daniel's version is immersive. He's performing in the place he lives to people he's going to see every day.
Irony doesn't inoculate against harm. If a neighbor takes the persona seriously, if they think Daniel believes he's superior because he lives on the 18th floor, they might feel judged. They might feel excluded. They might feel like the building is hostile in a way they hadn't noticed before.
Here's the counterpoint. The building is already doing that. The marketing is already drawing lines. The lobby is already intimidating. The key card is already saying you belong or you don't. Daniel's persona didn't create the class dynamic. It just made it visible.
That's the defense. He's not inventing the hierarchy. He's exposing it.
There's a real argument that making invisible hierarchies visible is ethically good. If the building is quietly telling everyone that height equals worth, maybe it's better to say it out loud and laugh at it than to let it work on people silently.
The danger is that some people won't hear the laughter. They'll just hear the hierarchy being affirmed. And if you're the one affirming it, even ironically, you're still the one saying the words.
Which is why the delivery matters so much. If you're going to run this experiment, you need to be legible as a performance to anyone who's paying attention. You're not just saying the ground is beneath you. You're saying you make the descent periodically to ensure the old ways are preserved among the ground-level communities.
The old ways. That's the tell. Nobody who believed they were superior would talk like a National Geographic documentary about their own city.
The more specific and absurd the vocabulary, the clearer the signal. You're not a snob. You're a method actor doing a bit about snobbery. And the bit is so committed, so detailed, that it becomes an invitation. Do you see what I'm doing? Do you want to play?
That's the practical implication. Daniel's persona is a form of social hacking. He's using the building's own language to create a shared in-group identity. The people who get the joke are instantly his people. The people who don't, well, they're part of the experiment too.
The risk is that it backfires. Someone takes it seriously and complains to management. Or someone feels hurt. Or the persona becomes a reputation that follows you beyond the building.
You become the guy. The guy in the elevator who talks about the lower world. And that's a hard reputation to shake, especially if you ever want to borrow sugar from someone.
The potential reward is real, too. Imagine finding two or three neighbors who are equally aware of the absurdity. Suddenly, you have a little community of people who can joke about the building's pretensions together. The persona stops being a solo performance and becomes a shared language.
A secret society of people who know the granite countertops are a lie.
That shared language is powerful. It transforms the building from a source of isolation into a source of connection. The very thing that separates you from the street, the height, the thresholds, the marketing, becomes the thing that bonds you to your neighbors.
Which is the best possible outcome? The persona starts as a joke about disconnection and ends up creating actual community.
Even the worst outcome is instructive. If nobody gets the joke, if everyone thinks you're insufferable, you've still learned something. You've learned that your neighbors bought into the marketing in a way you didn't. You've learned that the building's claims are working on them. That's valuable information about the place you live.
The experiment produces data either way. That's the cold way to put it. But the warmer version is, you're going to learn something about yourself in this process, and some of it might not be comfortable.
That's the third thing I think is worth sitting with. The persona might start as a joke, but playing with class signifiers has a way of surfacing your own assumptions. You start noticing when you feel more comfortable around certain neighbors. You catch yourself making snap judgments about people based on their floor number. The bid holds up a mirror to you too.
The mirror doesn't always show you what you want to see. You might discover that the condescension comes a little too easily, that the character you're playing isn't as far from who you actually are as you'd like to believe.
There's a reason method actors talk about characters getting under their skin. You spend enough time performing a worldview, the worldview starts to feel natural. The architecture is already pushing you in that direction. The height, the glass, the thresholds. If you add a performed personality on top of that, you're stacking the deck against yourself.
The practical advice here is, check in with yourself periodically. Ask whether the bit still feels like a bit. If you find yourself irritated by the ordinary denizens on the sidewalk, if the condescension stops being funny and starts being reflexive, it's time to take a break from the character.
That's not moralizing. It's just good experimental hygiene. You can't observe the results clearly if you've become the thing you were trying to observe.
If you're going to do this, whether you're Daniel or anyone else who finds themselves in a building with delusions of grandeur, how do you actually do it well? What are the specific moves?
The vocabulary is the engine. You need a complete lexicon. Trips to the ground are descents, journeys, expeditions. Non-residents are ground dwellers, street-level communities, the unelevated. The elevator isn't an elevator. It's the conveyance, the ascension chamber, the vertical transition module.
Vertical transition module. That's the kind of phrase that makes it impossible for anyone to think you're serious. The more technical and absurd the language, the clearer the signal.
You want your neighbors to hear the quotation marks. If you say, I'm just popping down to the shops, that's neutral. If you say, I'm making a brief descent to observe the commercial activities of the ground-level economy, the bit is unmistakable.
The dress should match the vocabulary. Non-expensive. That would be trying too hard. The kind of outfit that suggests you've never had to run for a bus. A single, well-chosen jacket. Shoes that have never touched a puddle.
Because you're above the weather. That's a real physical advantage of high-rise living you can work into the persona. You look out the window, you see rain, you put on a light jacket because by the time you reach the lobby, the storm is someone else's problem.
The lobby is climate buffer, another threshold the architecture provides for free.
The mannerisms matter. Move through the lobby like you're being processed, not like you're walking through a room. A slight nod to the front desk, not a greeting, an acknowledgement between professionals who both understand the gravity of the operation. In the elevator, a calm, unhurried posture. You're ascending. Ascension takes time.
Never rush in the elevator. Rushing is for people who are late. You are not late. You are arriving precisely when the building intends you to arrive.
When you meet a neighbor for the first time, the opening line is everything. You don't lead with the bit. You lead with something normal, let them respond, and then you drop a single phrase that tests the waters. Something like, it's remarkable how different the air feels up here. Or, I find I go down less and less these days.
That second one is perfect. It's ambiguous. It could be genuine. It could be a joke. The neighbor's response tells you everything you need to know. If they laugh, you've found a co-conspirator. If they nod seriously, you've found someone who bought the brochure.
If they look confused, you pull back. You're just making conversation. The air really does feel different up here. Must be the altitude.
The altitude on the 18th floor.
It's a microclimate.
The beauty of the bit is that it's scalable. You can dial it up or down depending on the audience. With a neighbor who gets it, you can go full vertical supremacy. With someone who doesn't, you just sound mildly poetic about the view. No harm done.
The shared language with neighbors who get it becomes its own reward. Suddenly, you're not just living in a building with strangers. You're part of a secret society of people who understand that the Emperor's luxury tower has no clothes. You can joke about the resort-style pool that's just a pool. The chef's kitchen that's just a kitchen with an island.
The curated resident lounge that's just a room with a couch nobody sits on.
The persona stops being a solo performance and becomes a collaborative art project. You and your neighbors co-authoring the building's true mythology.
Which is valuable. Community is hard to build in vertical buildings. The architecture works against it. If a shared joke about the building's pretensions is what it takes to actually talk to your neighbors, that's a net positive.
Even if the experiment fails. Even if nobody gets the joke and you become known as the weird guy on 14, you've still conducted a successful investigation. You now know something about your building that you didn't know before. You know that the marketing has worked on your neighbors in a way it hasn't worked on you. That's useful information about the social environment you're living in.
The experiment produces knowledge either way. The only real failure is if you never learn anything from it.
I think the broader lesson here, the thing anyone can take from this, even if they're not planning to start referring to their elevator as an ascension chamber, is that the best social trolling exposes the gap between what something claims to be and what it actually is. You're not inventing the pretension. You're just refusing to pretend it isn't there.
The building made the claim. You're just taking it seriously. If that makes people uncomfortable, the discomfort was already latent in the architecture. You just turn the lights on.
That's a transferable skill. It works on more than buildings. Any institution that makes inflated claims about itself is vulnerable to this kind of treatment. Take the claims literally. Act as if they're true. Watch what happens.
The persona as a research method. The bit as an epistemology.
Daniel would appreciate that framing. The question I can't stop turning over is, what happens when the persona stops being a persona? If Daniel keeps this up for 6 months, a year, waking up in the tower, riding the ascension chamber, talking about the lower world, does the bit eventually become sincere?
The architecture doesn't take days off. Every morning the view is there. You look down and the city is literally beneath you. That's not a metaphor you have to work to maintain. It's just there. The building is doing the performance for you, whether you're in character or not.
That's the thing about immersive performances. Method actors talk about the difficulty of shedding a role after months of inhabiting it. But they get to leave the set. Daniel lives on the set.
The set is also his kitchen. That's a level of immersion even De Niro would find excessive.
It raises a genuine psychological question. We know that physical environments shape cognition. High ceilings promote abstract thinking. Confined spaces increase stress. Living above other people, with a daily visual reminder that you are literally elevated, that has to do something to your sense of self over time.
The persona might accelerate that process. You start performing condescension as a joke, but the performance gives you permission to feel things you might otherwise suppress. The bit becomes a safe container for impulses that were already there.
The joke is permission structure. I'm not really a snob, I'm just playing one. But the snob is getting more airtime than the real you at this point.
The neighbors who buy into the persona, the ones who think you're serious and agree with you, they reinforce it. You make a joke about the ground-level communities, they nod earnestly, and suddenly you're in a feedback loop. The character is getting validated by real social interaction.
That's the danger. The persona stops being something you do and starts being something you are. Not because you wanted it to, but because the environment and the social dynamics and the sheer repetition made it easier to stay in character than to step out.
Which is why I think the most important part of Daniel's experiment is the part he probably hasn't planned. The exit strategy. How do you stop being the vertical supremacy guy once you've established yourself as the vertical supremacy guy?
You'd have to move. That's the cleanest exit. New building, new persona, fresh start.
Or you could stage a dramatic fall. Announce to your neighbors that you've been humbled, that you made a descent and realized the ground-level communities have a wisdom you'd overlooked. The persona evolves into a redemption arc.
A come-to-earth moment.
Even that is still a performance. You'd be trading one character for another. The only real exit is to stop performing entirely. And that might be harder than starting, because by then the neighbors have expectations. They know you as the guy who talks about the lower world. If you suddenly start being normal, they'll think something's wrong.
You've trapped yourself in your own bit. the most dangerous animal in the comedy ecosystem.
Yet I keep coming back to the larger question underneath all of this. As cities get denser and more vertical, these dynamics aren't going away. More people are going to be living above other people. More buildings are going to be marketing themselves as luxury sanctuaries. The physical hierarchy of the city is getting more pronounced, not less.
The UN projects that by 2030, 1 in 3 people will live in cities with at least 500,000 residents. And in the densest cities, the only direction to build is up. Vertical living isn't a niche lifestyle. It's the future of urban housing for a huge portion of the population.
Daniel's experiment isn't just a weird hobby. It's a preview of a social dynamic that's going to become more common. How do you maintain connection across physical hierarchies when the architecture of the city is constantly reinforcing those hierarchies?
The luxury marketing makes it worse, because it takes a physical fact. I live on the 18th floor and turns it into a moral claim. I have ascended. The language of the brochures isn't just describing a building, it's constructing an identity. And as more people live in buildings that make these claims, more people are going to internalize them, whether they realize it or not.
Daniel's persona is just the most honest version of that internalization. He's not pretending the marketing doesn't work on him. He's showing exactly how it works, by doing it deliberately and visibly.
The best trolling makes people think. And what this persona makes you think about is the absurdity of a world where luxury means nothing and everything at the same time. Where the countertops are granite and the view is glass, and the brochure says you're special, and none of it means anything except that you're high up and the door locks behind you.
The persona is a mirror. It shows the building what it actually looks like when someone takes its claims seriously. And the reflection isn't flattering, but it is honest.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The raffia palm fibers traditionally harvested in Madagascar are soaked in a solution of tannic acid extracted from local tree bark before weaving, a chemical treatment that cross-links the cellulose polymers and increases the fiber's tensile strength by roughly 40%, making raffia one of the few natural cordage materials that actually gets stronger when wet.
Right?
This has been my Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, rate and review us wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We're back next week.
Try not to look down.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.